Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Dolores Handy. Tonight, we hear from five scholars on the legacy of Yasek Curran, one of the most important opposition leaders in Eastern Europe, both as a thinker and practitioner, who died last June. Speaking tonight, in order, will be Andrei Tomalski, Director of International Programs at the American Council on Learned Societies; Patrick Kenny, Professor of History at the University of Colorado, Boulder; Johanna Rogalska, Professor of Geography and Chair of the Department of Women's and Gender Studies at Rutgers University; David Ost, Professor of Political Science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges; and Jacques Rupnik, Professor of Political Science and Research Director at CERI, Foundation Nationale de Sciences Politiques, Paris, Professor of History at the Sorbonne, and Professor of Politics at the Institut d'Études Politiques, Paris. We begin with an introduction from the Director of the Institute of Human Sciences at Boston University, Irena Grudzinska-Gross.
Good evening. My name is Irena Grudzinska-Gross, and I'm the Director of the Institute of Human Sciences. Here at Boston University, the Institute serves as a forum for new nonpartisan debate, research, and education in matters of international, especially transatlantic relations. It is affiliated with the Vienna-based Institute für die Wissenschaft und Menschen, an independent interdisciplinary center for advanced study in humanities and social sciences. Tonight, in cooperation with the American Council of Learned Societies and the journal East European Politics and Societies, we bring you a very special event, a commemoration of Yasek Curran. Yasek Curran, as most of you know, was one of the most important oppositional leaders in Eastern Europe, both as a thinker and practitioner. He was also much loved and admired by many of us here in this room, and it is particularly gratifying to be able to celebrate his memory together. The speakers are in alphabetical order: Patrick Kenny, professor at the University of Colorado; David Ost, who is a professor of political science at the Hobart and William Smith Colleges; Johanna Rogalska, Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Professor of Geography at Rutgers University; Professor Jacques Rupnik, Professor of Political Science and Research Director at the Fondation Nationale de Sciences Politiques in Paris; and Andrzej Tomalski, Director of International Programs at the American Council of Learned Society, with whom we are organizing today this event together. Let me, as an introduction, say a few words about Curran's life and legacy to set up our conversation discussion. Yasek Curran was born in 1934 in the then Polish and now Ukrainian city of Lviv. An important fact, especially today, that he credited with inspiring in him a sustained interest in all matters Ukrainian. After the brutal experience of Second World War, he moved to Warsaw, where in the 50s he joined the Communist Party and founded the Red Scouting Organization. In 1956, during the Polish October, he participated in workers' protests and was expelled from the party, which he rejoined again only to be expelled once more. In the late 60s and 70s, between several prison stays, he was one of the most fearless and imaginative leaders of the democratic opposition. His most famous quote came as the protesting workers were setting fire in 1970 to the building that housed party, Communist Party Committee headquarters. He said, "Don't burn committee headquarters, found your own." I'm sure many people will be talking about it or quoting this, innovative decision. He was a founding member of the Workers' Defense Committee and of the Baltic Coast Workers' Committee, an institution that led to the creation of Solidarity Movement. When the introduction of martial law ended the short period of liberty in Poland, he again was sent to prison. In 1989, he played a very important role in the Roundtable Accords and in the formation of the first democratic government, in which he served as Minister of Labor and Social Policy, taking upon himself, as usual, the most difficult and thankless task of reconciling market reforms with social protections. Gradually incapacitated by illness, he never stopped agitating for social justice and citizens' self-organization. Now I would like to say, besides these facts of his life, I should add something, because these facts do not reflect the extraordinary character of the man himself. If I were to describe him, I would stress two characteristics. One, his political inventiveness, and second, his courage. We talk often about courage. We think we know what it is, but I was always astonished by the way Kuroń walked through life, ahead of everybody, risking prison, which he detested, and in which he spent altogether 9 years of his life. But his courage was much more fundamental, deeper than risking prison. He was never somebody dictated to. He always said what he thought, and what he thought was almost never generally accepted. He was a self-directed man. It is hard to talk about such things without sounding banal, but believe me, his was an everyday courage of a truly independent person. Second was his political inventiveness. If in politics, which is, after all, a collaborative activity, you could establish a patent, Kuroń would have had several of them. He contributed mightily to the dissolution of the communist system by creating several new institutions, the most important of them being the Workers' Defense Committee, and by proposing new ways of public behavior that now seem very obvious, acting under one's own name, public protest, open contact with foreign mass media, including even very much feared at that time in the 70s and 60s, Radio Free Europe. These new political means could function only if linked to the first Kuroń characteristic I mentioned, gigantic personal courage. Indomitable energy, inventiveness, courage, and energy. These were the ingredients of the Kuroń cocktail, which disarmed the communist authorities in Poland. After 1989, very importantly, he continued his fight against apathy and submission to what he would have called capitalist fundamentalism. He did not cease to be a dissident. His death on June 17, 2004, at the age of 70, caused a massive outpouring of grief. In Polish public life of the last few years, it was one of the very few moments of near unanimity. This massive outpouring showed this recognition that Kuroń brought a moral dimension to politics and a political dimension to our lives. He inspired people by believing in individual moral action, and I hope we'll be able to follow in his steps. Thank you. And now, Andrzej Tymoski.
Thank you very much, Irena. I want to begin my remarks with two premises and then go on to ask some questions and maybe draw some tentative conclusions. My first premise has to do with Jacek Kuroń's legacy. He took on many roles in his life. Irena detailed them. They range from being a young communist, a founder of a red socialist scouting organization, political pamphleteer, advisor to Solidarity, taking a road that not everyone took. So in the 1980s, he was a friend to the so-called new social movements that supported everything from environmental protection to draft resistance. In the 1990s, of course, the soup kitchens, his various activities as Minister of Labor and Social Policy to try to bring together labor unions and employers' associations and government officials to bring them together to try to negotiate social policy. It seems to me, and this is my first premise, that these many roles that Jacek Kuroń took on were all driven by his basic instinct for social activism. He was a born organizer, and he understood this as being mutual aid, people helping people. Everything he thought, everything he did to encourage self-organization, societal self-organization, as he called it, to defend the rights of the weak, the dispossessed, to make the world better. My second premise is that this kind of social activism is today in danger. We might even say, looking at the situation in the United States, it's under attack. The Bush administration is using the war on terrorism to justify surveillance of activist organizations, increasing militarization, and to stigmatize and silence those who would think differently. In the international sphere, Vladimir Vladimirovich Putin and George Georgievich Bush look deeply into each other's souls and are now both prosecuting wars in the Middle East and Central Asia. Of course, neither Iraq nor Chechnya are wars, but they are long-term occupations motivated by the mission of civilizing local populations, whether they want to be civilized or not. Where's Central and Eastern Europe in this scenario? Well, it's where it has always been, coughing for breath, caught between the East and the West as these two great tectonic plates grind against one another. The rhetorical landscape has changed since the end of the Cold War. It's now no longer the clash between communism and capitalism, but the global war on terror. But for for Central and Eastern Europe, the situation really remains the same of being caught in between great powers. And I go into this at some length because it needs to be pointed out that Yitzhak Kuran was an energetic critic of the invasion of Iraq, energetic and isolated in his opposition. Almost all of his friends and former fellow dissidents enthusiastically supported the invasion. They were extremely angry with Yitzhak because he opposed the war. Okay, there is a second danger that I want to point to social activism. It's of a very different character. It's not an external threat like the one I've just mentioned, but an sort of gnawing internal danger. And it's what we might call the bureaucratization or the corporatization of social movements. All this said, what can we learn from Yitzhak Kuran's legacy, from his kind of social activism? I don't think it's possible to deduce a grand strategy. I don't think actually it's possible to have a grand strategy. But I think we can certainly identify a few basic principles that we could use as guides. First, social activism must have a moral compass, and that moral compass is helping people. Kuran ceaselessly repeated in the 1970s and afterwards that the political opposition in Poland needed to do more than to criticize and organize against the regime. It needed to help its victims, to defend workers who were jailed, to give money and food to their families. But the second principle is just as important. Social activism is not an apolitical charity. Kuran organized soup kitchens in the 1990s in the free and independent Poland that he helped to bring about because people were hungry. But he was deeply embarrassed that the democracy and the market economy, which he supported and which he helped bring into existence, had produced so many destitute people who had no place to turn except soup kitchens. So therefore, as the Minister of Labor and Social Policy, as a private person, as an organizer, he sought to help those who suffered most in the transition to democracy and market. We can sum up these two principles, I think, in the slogan, act locally, but think critically. And the third principle follows, I think. Social activism requires the courage of one's conviction. For Kuran, this courage meant being a rebel. As Karol Modzelewski recently pointed out, for which he was also very strongly criticized, Yitzhak was a rebel not just in People's Poland. He was a rebel in the new democratic Poland. He was a gadfly and a thorn in the side of the authorities. This made him an inconvenient person, and he made many of his friends and former fellow dissidents uncomfortable after 1989, by his criticism of capitalist fundamentalism and by his criticism of the war in Iraq. So I don't have a grand proposal to make, but I think with Yitzhak that if we dare to think critically, to act in the spirit of mutual aid and societal self-organization, and have the courage to speak truth to power, we will find a way. Thank you.
Well, I would now like to take you for a few minutes into Yitzhak Kuran's childhood. I was fortunate to be able to interview Yitzhak Kuran on the last day before he went into the hospital for the last time in May. And, of course, looking back, one would wish that one had asked some great, profound questions and gotten the answers, and I could share them with you. But as I reflected on that interview and listened to it again, I realized that he did have some things he wanted to say, perhaps thinking about this being one of his last interviews. And he wanted to talk about a little bit about his childhood in one particular way. He shared with me a list of books that he had felt had been formative in his life he said he began reading these as a 6 or 7 year old. And so I decided that the best thing I could possibly do for this panel was to spend the last month reading these books and thus entering the world of the 6, 8, 10, 12 year old Yitzhak Kuran. I certainly enjoyed them a great deal, and I also felt when I had finished them that I did understand better how he became and why he became a political activist, why he became a political prisoner and who he was as a politician. First, Jan Dombrowski na zachód od Zanzibaru. Dombrowski was an editor of Tijin Robotnika, a PPS journal, a socialist journal. Kuron would have read it right after the war in a 46 edition. This is a series of short stories in somewhat romantic, sentimental language about the lives and sometimes the deaths of homeless children and their families in the slums of pre-war Warsaw. Zanzibar, and I'm really not quite clear if this was real or not, but Kuron claims it was. He said this was an area north of Żoliborz, so north of where he lived until his death, in an area that is now a large blokowisko. At that time, barracks inhabited by homeless children. This book, although it's not well known now, was quite popular at the time. Julian Tuwim was a big fan, apparently. It's quite an apolitical book. It's sort of a documentation of the lives of these children and their worldview. I could pair with this, probably the most obscure book on this list, Izidor Koszykowski, Dziecko ulicy, first published in 1949 by Biblioteka Trybuny Ludu. Nonetheless worth reading, maybe not worth republishing, but a wonderful book, actually. It's an autobiography of an orphan born in 1901 and found on Ulica Koszykowa, hence his last name. So he really was a dziecko ulicy. He describes his rejection by the state, by the church, by his school, and yet even so fighting in the Polish-Soviet, first in World War I and then in the Polish-Soviet War. Koszykowski takes his story through 1926. After the story in the book, he becomes a communist. He dies in 1942, executed along with other members of the Communist Party in Warsaw during one of the mass executions by the Nazis. Reading these two books, I found themes which will not surprise anyone who knew Jacek Kuron or who has read his wonderful memoirs. Both offer unflinching looks at the poverty and sometimes the cruelty of Poland before 1939. While ethnicity, a theme that was important to Kuron, is generally absent from these stories, class is ever present. Dombrowski's children live in a permanent underclass in which someone unemployed appears as an elite. If you have a pink card showing that you're unemployed, you're registered as unemployed, you're entitled to one's own bowl of soup, for example. Work in these stories is no salvation. There, one is simply subject to the whims or tortures of the boss, and one is always a step from unemployment. The characters are always in search of a place to sleep or few zlotys to buy a meal. This is a world that Kuron knew. As many of you know, he grew up in a stable, well-educated home in Lviv, but spent his childhood with children just like this, the pickpockets and the children of unemployed or underemployed in Lviv. The lessons from Izidor Koszykowski are somewhat different. His Warsaw is a cruel world where even the poor are set against the poor. The hero is mistreated by everyone but one foster mother. As an apprentice, as a schoolboy, as a soldier, he finds stupidity and venality everywhere. And what is quite different from other memoirs of this type is that the hero never gets ahead, even through education and hard work. For Koszykowski, the moral was clear. One could not make it in capitalist Poland, at least in pre-war capitalist Poland. Koszykowski does offer a way out, though. Justice may not prevail, but one must stand up for oneself to survive. He portrays himself fighting with his officers during the war, refusing stupid assignments and even stupider punishments. He fights with his peers as a child. Born without a name, he must constantly prove himself, even if he cannot improve his position by doing so. It's a book full of pathos, but also full of anger. Koszykowski knows how to swear and how to condemn injustice. And one needn't read it as a communist tract, though that is how it's portrayed in its 1949 edition, as you might well imagine. One can imagine that it's an excellent inspiration for the 14 or 15-year-old Kuron to join the communist struggle, as he did for some time. Next, Urka Nachalnik, Życiorys własny przestępcy, the autobiography of a criminal. This was first published in 1933. Nachalnik is a rather hard story to fit into Kuron's life. It was written while he was serving time for bank robbery in Rawicz prison in the early 1930s. Nachalnik is a pseudonym. He learned written Polish only in prison. He was first educated in a yeshiva and eventually became slightly more educated in Polish only as a teenager. He afterwards was executed in the Otwock ghetto during the Holocaust. His memoir is an account of his difficult early life and education and his slow transformation into a practiced criminal. Now, one thing I learned through Kuron's eyes as I read this, it is full of instructions about how to survive in prison. I cannot be sure that this was a book that he always had in his mind or often had in his mind in prison. Some of you may know that Kuron had a very interesting practice which he developed in prison, and that is that when he would enter a new prison cell, he would announce to everyone present that he was Jewish. which is the source for many people's belief today that he actually, in fact, was Jewish. This was for him, in part, a sociological experiment. But I think it was also, in part, a desire to inhabit Urkan Nahalnik's world. For the young Kuron, long before he went to prison, I think it was part of his desire to understand other people and to see life from their perspective. And thus later, to not just impersonate a fellow Warsaw intellectual in prison, but to really inhabit someone else's life, even if it means suffering as well. I'll be a Jew, and let's see what happens. I want to experience that suffering at the same time. On the other hand, this is a book which ends on November 11th, 1918. Clearly a book suffused with a Polish patriotism, even for those who do not want you to be a Polish patriot. Finally, one that I think might be the most familiar for some of you, Sergiusz Piasecki, Kochanek Wielkiej Niedźwiedzicy, The Lover of the Great Bear. Piasecki is much more famous for many of his books. This was his first one, also like Nahalnik's book, written in prison. Both Nahalnik and Piasecki were discovered in prison in the 1930s. So I guess there's a whole genre of prison literature. Lover of the Great Bear, the title means if you are smuggling across the Polish-Soviet border and you lose your way, you keep the Great Bear constellation on your right and you'll always be able to get back into Poland. It's a fictionalized account of Piasecki's life as a smuggler of goods and people across the Polish-Soviet border in the 1930s, a career which landed him, too, in jail. The entire book is essentially about the defense of one's honor. The hero claims over and over that he works not for money but for the love of the job. He's an honest smuggler, refusing money, reimbursing fellow smugglers. It's a book of comradeship as well and the inconvenience of borders across the multi-ethnic Kresy. One could hardly imagine a more fitting book for the young Kuron, and he says he found it at the age of 7. Looking ahead to what would shape Kuron's life and thought, I see the following themes coming out of all of these books. First, compassion. These books inspire compassion, of course. They're books about hardship. But they also show people who are not well off or persecuted, like Piasecki or Koszykowski, helping others. I would add that the world of thieves and the world of smugglers are here actually self-help societies. Their existence justified by repression of some kind. Second, belief in the fundamental goodness of the underworld. In our interview, Jacek spoke movingly of the vanished world of Zanzibar, a district which was so close to his home, a place where he still clearly felt quite at home. Third, I think in some ways perhaps most important, honor. All of these books, all of these readings return constantly to the theme of honor, and I believe this was one of the most important themes for Jacek Kuron as well. Honor is something which one defends and articulates constantly to one another, of course, within one's own world, but also to those outside. And out of that comes the fourth theme, the struggle for justice rooted, as Andrzej has already mentioned, rooted in the moral ideas of combating social inequality. Now, I think it was clear to me, at least in retrospect, and I think I still believe this is the case, that Kuron would say that, in a way, he did not change from that time, from the time when he read those books, coincidentally also the time of World War II, and has carried those lessons straight from his childhood reading through his entire life as a politician. Thank you.
Thank you very much. This is a real surprise to me. This is not a typical reading of a Polish child. And of course, Kuron was not a typical anything. Yes. So, Joanna Reguska.
As always, these kind of occasions are sad and yet, I think, extremely powerful. And for me, it was an opportunity to really think about the connections that I felt many times with Jacek in the work that he was doing and that I was doing, and yet never have really a moment to kind of reflect on where these connections are and how these connections came to be about. When Irena asked me, I had two images came to my mind when I began to think about Jacek and his work. The first one was many, many years ago in the 70s, and it was Puławska Street. It was an apartment full of people. It was an apartment of which you were very often asked for ID when you were walking in by the Plaintkov police, and yet an apartment of which police never actually entered. And here we were, crowded, smoky room. Jacek was sitting, speaking, arguing, strategizing, persuaded. This was all with an incredible passion. Somebody who was extremely involved in his body and his language, He was there with his soul. This was something about building the, obviously, the better hope, the future. We were all there because we were hoping that something eventually going to come. He was in his jeans and denim jacket, and that's something that carries with him across through his life. The second image was about 20 years later. It was 1994. It was March. I was organizing with an informal group, women also, a two-day seminar. This was just before the local elections. The second round of the local elections were taking place in May 1994. And what we were trying to do is to persuade journalists, local journalists from Gazeta Wyborcza, who was covering the whole Poland, to actually write about two things. One, to write about the local government, write about local elections, try to continue to persuade people that these are important principles, that these are important reforms, that what was said initially, that indeed you can take your actions in your own hands and do something about it, that indeed this is still valid, even though the politicians forgot about you and majority of the government by that time didn't care too much about the citizens. There was the moment where the spirit of the late 80s and beginning of 90s began to fade away in a certain way. So we asked Jacek to come. But there was another agenda, not only talking about the local government and local elections, but also to have Jacek to talk about that having women in public office is an extremely important, and this is part of the democratic practices and part of the democratic change that we want to see in the country. So he had a double role to play there. He was supposed to be the keynote speaker, but he was supposed to be a man speaking about the importance of this very patriarchal country where clearly the position of women has been still marginalized. So here's this again, persuading, strategizing, analyzing, speaking with passion, being home in his soul and body and a vision and trying to build these connections between people and already networking between them and trying to bring them together. And, you know, there are about 20 years between these two moments. And yet, it really didn't change so much. He was there the way he was. His vision was still there. He believed in what he was saying, and he was trying to bring people together in a way that it will make sense, in a way that people will start working together, in a way that people will feel empowered, that they will be ready to go and do something, that the journalists will be ready to write about these important issues. So that kind of unchange that already we've heard, you know, it was in the 50s, was in the 60s, was in the 70s, but it was still in the 90s, and it was still needed, even though the regime has changed, because somehow things were fading in a way that they should have not faded because the promises were different, and yet Jacek was needed there still to be this activist and yet the most popular politician, but still in his activist soul. Jacek clearly believed in the empowered citizenry. For him, in many ways, power was located in social movements, and as citizens who will be able to act, to take action, to take control of the issues and important elements in their own hands. He believes strongly that non-governmental organizations have to be established in order to provide citizens with the channels through which they could participate, but also that non-governmental organizations were needed in order to work with the citizens, to help them, to learn new skills, to build a platform for collective action, to build the platform for the community agendas. His vision of what allows democracy to be practiced and allows citizens to gain a sense of belonging and being to make a difference included many critical elements, and just few of them, which when I was thinking came to my mind, were the existence of deeply rooted grassroots practices, collective networking, the possibilities of a continuous dialogue, even though sometimes broken, between different local actors. And yes, what Andrew was already talking about, the personal commitment, the personal political will to actually be there with the soup kitchen or just talking to people. But Jacek also believed in a strong state. And this was, as we know, a position of contradiction for him. On the one hand, he believed in a state that would provide for citizens, state that would care and that would provide variety of services. He cared about the weakest, those which indeed need the most, the elderly, the sick, the poor. But at the same time, as was already mentioned, he was the minister in two governments, which put into the place many institutions and practices that, in fact, created more of the people who were in the demand of those services and protection of the state. He did apologize, and he said that he, in many ways, has messed up that he created something that, in the end, was not about what exactly he believed. His political vision was then based on strong state, but also strong citizenry. And he saw possibility for building linkages between the two. So, for example, he did believe that by creating at the local scale the non-governmental organizations and the new alliances between them and the local government, we could actually initiate a lot of socially responsible projects that will both bring the responsibility of the state at the local level and also allow the citizens to work through the non-governmental channels to create those local agenda. As you also may know, that more recently he actually called for the action beyond the nation state. Not only was opposing the war in Iraq, but he also voiced quite a bit of anti-capitalist and anti-globalization movement opposition. And as usually, what was his call? His call was actually for young to take action. To take action as the future, he said, lies in your own hands. So no matter where the call was located, whether at the local or global level, that kind of a commitment to the activism and the commitment to the empowered citizenry was always there. I do miss him in many ways because it was a figure of building the civil society in its best, even though sometimes it was not translated in the way that he would like to see it. But he did love people, and people loved him. And he maintained for many, many years the number one position of being the most popular and the most trusted politician. And I hope in that way he remains with us too. Thank you.
Thank you, Irena and Andre, for organizing this panel. It's an honor to be here and be able to talk about it. With this. Unlike, I think, everyone else at this panel, I mean, I've met many people in the Polish political opposition in the past, but Jacek Kuran I only met once. And it was, I can't tell a great story about it. It wasn't a very good encounter. I was, I've seen him many times, seen him present, seen him in public many times. And then I finally arranged one appointment, and he was a little busy, and I came into his house, and he didn't have much time, and he was looking at his watch, and he didn't know me, and I thought, and I tried to impress on him, or I wanted to, that he could talk with me openly, but how can I do that in such a short time? He didn't have much time. So in the end, it wasn't a very good encounter. But maybe, you know, this why I introduced that is because I don't have, I can't speak of many personal encounters with Kuran, but it's precisely, you know, maybe that gives me more of an ability, I would like to think, perhaps, you know, in taking him seriously as a political thinker, right, and as a political activist, and to see, you know, the kind of grand and great work that he did, and also to see what I think are some of his own failures from his own point of view as well in the later years, in the last years of his life. I mean, in the last years of his life, he pretty much absented himself from political activity and was doing some serious writing. And he was not very happy with the new reality, but didn't know what his role should be. And actually, that points to something that I think is really central to Jacek Kuran all along, and perhaps the source of both his greatness and also his some difficulty in accepting him in Polish culture. In fact, just 2 weeks ago, there was a conflict, I think it was in Łódź, where they wanted to name a public school after Jacek Kuran, and then some of the Catholic circles said, a public school after this old communist? Are you crazy? You know, and then it was a big thing in the paper, and finally they did name the public school after him. But, I expect that there'll be a lot more of these things in the future as his legacy becomes more contentious. Because he's a man very much in between. He's a man in between within the left. He's very much a man of the left, but in between the old left and the new left, as I'll talk about in a moment, and a post-left. He's never fully in any one of them. Also has a very interesting relationship to Polish Catholicism, while originally an atheist for much of his life. Around the time that the opposition movement became more acceptable, more popular in Poland, he tried to become more of a religious person. Now, what's this in-betweenness within the left? Part of it is due to his very generation. He was born in 1934, both too old to be a part, too old to be a part of the student generation of the 1960s, and simultaneously too young to be a stalwart of the old left, right? He was 10 years old when People's Poland came in 1944. You know, he's different from both generations. He certainly does share a lot with that old left. In fact, you know, one of his first, as he talks about it, everyone notes about his role in the scout movements. He went into the scout movements and wanted to be a pedagogue, and entered the scouts for that purpose. But his model was the old Russian Bolshevik Anton Makarenko, a Soviet pedagogue, right? A Bolshevik pedagogue who wrote about a Bolshevik pedagogy, what it's supposed to mean. I was fascinated with these ideas. Makarenko proposed such things as, found this quote from a Makarenko piece, and it makes sense of seeing Kuron in that light. Proposed such things as, quote, the involvement of all pupils without exception, including juniors. Everyone knows that's something that was always central to Kuron. Late in his life, when he wanted to, you know, when he reached out to the alter globalists to bring in the youth, you know, even in the 60s, when he's an older man had already served time in prison and wants to make room for the younger generation, you know, and exceedingly generous towards someone like Adam Michnik, who we could have perceived as a rival, you know, and certainly did not. You know, there was always that reaching out and that commitment to involvement of everyone. That's one connection with the old left. There's also, of course, the open letter, the famous open letter of 1965 that he wrote together with Karol Modzelewski. I reread it again in preparation for this. And it's, of course, you know, a classic argument of the old left. It's a very it's a pretty straightforward Trotskyist critique of real socialism, talking about there's a betrayal of the revolution, and we need a new workers' uprising, using categories that this was a somewhat of a socialist revolution, and that's why he still is calling for its reform, and yet at the same time it had been betrayed, and we need, you know, a workers' uprising here to get rid of, you know, this dissection of the bureaucratic state, as he calls it, is something alien to true Marxism. And in that way, of course, the letter is very much part of the old left. He went to jail for the first time because of that letter, 3.5 years. And when he came out, things had changed and the political environment had changed, and he had moved on. Unlike his co-writer, Modzelewski, who stayed more loyal to those old left principles and to this day still is, Kuron moved on from there, moved away from there, and opened up in a very positive way to that new student generation. And here is where I think, in the 1970s, is where I think he made his real great theoretical contribution, I mean, where he emerges as a great and profound thinker, I think. Because he was an instrumental figure in the rediscovery of the concept of civil society. But what was his activism in the 70s? What was it about? The famous slogan, don't burn down committees, start your own, is well known, though I actually never read it. I don't know where he ever said it. I know he said it, but I never saw where. But I don't think that itself was the innovation. I mean, you know, it's such, it means that new organizations are necessary, which made a tactical break with Marxist revisionism, but in itself was no real theoretical innovation. What I think was a real theoretical innovation was his reconceptualization of the political in his writings in the early 1970s. A series of essays, What is the political opposition in Poland, where he plays a key role in trying to reinterpret the meaning of the political as not referring simply to state-based activity, not referring to toppling the state, but referring to activism among people, among social groups. That there's a political opposition just by everyone doing their own independent activity. And that there's a sense in which this can be and needs to be considered a kind of political resistance without having a clear sense of what we're about to do, of what we want to do. We will free ourselves the notion of anticipatory democracy. We can't have a democratic society now, but we'll act now as if we live in a democratic society. I really think that the basic idea, the structure and the ideology of the early Solidarity organization was very much based around many of these ideas that Kuron and others that I put forth in the 1970s, this notion of self-limiting revolution, yes, because we're not trying to take power, but this notion of civic activism and of mobilizing ourselves and this consistent mobilization, you know, proved to be extremely successful in leading to that movement. Now, What about afterwards? Well, I get the sense from reading his work, following him later on, seeing his disappointment late in life, that there was always a certain, that he always felt in a certain way that there was also a kind of failure, too, because it wasn't a model of government. It wasn't a model of governing. And he really didn't have much of a model of governing, per se. I mean, at first, when martial law came, 1981, the end of 81, he suffered a kind of crisis. He was one of the first arrested. And in fact, for a very short time, hardly ever talked about, because he passed through this phase very quickly, smuggled out a letter to the underground, widely published, where he calls for armed insurrection. You know, going back to some old left roots, no doubt. You know, seeing that, my God, this was solidarity. We were a self-limiting revolution. Look how easily we were crushed. And it seems for a moment, you imagine that, well, you know, maybe that old left idea wasn't so bad. In other words, you know, now we got crushed. And everyone on the outside who were very influenced by him, Zbigniew Bujak, wrote, you know, Jacek, we learned from you that we don't do these things. So, of course, we're not going to follow you now, right? You were our mentor. So we disagree with you. And he passed over that very quickly and didn't move back to it. Over the course of the 80s, though, he also seemed to be a little, well, very much more skeptical of popular mobilization. He seemed to see, this is another interview he gave late in the Solidarity period, and in fact forbade its publication at the time. It was only published when martial law was declared, where he said he saw so much of this activism and solidarity and so much on the part of people who didn't really care about politics, and he seemed to be moving away from this notion of just, you know, of open civic activism for everyone and moved more in the line of trying to negotiate a settlement with the authorities. And, of course, he became one of the key figures in the Roundtable Accords. Then, of course, he joined the government, became labor minister. And in some way, he helped play a role in this, in actually delegitimizing the idea of civil society. It became more charity organization. I mean, as he himself became very critical of his activity, so I am with him in being more critical of this, you know. And I think having these soup kitchens, which of course is a fine thing to do, you know. I mean, it's charity work, right? But he felt that really not much else was possible. You know, he came up with some ideas and never fully satisfied with them. His own summation of his life and his work late in his life had something still missing, where he never fully found himself in that new reality after 1989. You know, it's not a criticism of it, you know. It's not a criticism of it. It's an observation, and one that I would think that, I would hope that he himself would not disagree with. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, David. I have read the same piece of news in the newspaper about this elementary school that people protested against having his name on it. But what I read was that they protested because he was smoking a lot and drinking a lot.
Oh, is that right?
Jacques Rupnik now, please.
Thank you very much. I can certainly testify to the last proposition. Absolutely accurate. Of course, coming last, my task is both much easier because everything has been said and therefore much more difficult. So I can afford to be very, very brief. I had initially thought of saying something in terms of three paradoxes of Jacek Kuroń. One has to do with him as the symbol of the struggle, of the dissident struggle against communism that eventually brings down the communist regime, but who himself had been a very committed communist himself. And that is part of the story that is often marginalized. And that is a very interesting, if one wants to understand what happened in Central Europe in the last half century, it really is absolutely essential to understand the biographies of people like Jacek Kuroń. So that, I think, is crucially important. I had interviewed him in the mid-80s on that subject for a project of the Other Europe. And he, I interviewed a number of people on this. He gave me the best, the clearest answers. They had to do with World War II, with the experience of the war. The destruction, the Holocaust, the physical destruction. And after an experience like that, when you come so close to experiencing hell, you not in the mood of joining, mild center liberal orientation or social democratic program. No, you want a radical change. You want a clean start. And he explained in a very powerful way the attraction for that generation of the communist idea. And of course, we know what happened to that and what has been done in the name of that idea as well. But I think that is a very interesting... his biography is actually crucial to understanding not just Poland, but Central Europe after the war, even if we take the two key contributions of Kuroń. The 60s, his influence on the 60s generation, the 68s, if you want, and List Otwarty, the open letter. There you have the most articulated, if you want, leftist Marxist critique of the system, a critique from within. And there are not that many documents of that type in East Central Europe. That was certainly the most emblematic, and it had an impact much beyond Poland. It was very, and even, I must say, since people evoke their personal recollections, that was the first text of that kind that I had read. I had read it after, I read it only in 68, but made enormous impact, not only on myself, but people who I knew in the student movement, in both in Prague and even in Paris. So that was his the critique from within, and if you want, 10 years after, the critique from without, the foundation of CORE. And it has been already explained here, the idea of self-organization of society, the idea of civil society, the self-limiting revolution, the idea that the conquest of power is pointless, not only because the threat of a Soviet invasion, but also because conquering power means entering into a logic that produced some of the terrible things we know from the past. So that was a major contribution, I think, and he provided, I think, or helped provide that political intellectual background to the Solidarity movement. But it strikes me that he belongs to a great generation of Polish rebels, of Polish intellectuals in opposition, and that's a long tradition that 2 centuries old at least. And he says in his book that he read Bogdan Cywinski's Genealogy of the Unsubordinated. I don't know whether that would be the English translation. And he reflects about that tradition, and he's interested in what? He's interested in what is it that makes them able to sacrifice themselves for something. And he deals, of course, with this is where religion comes into it, and he's interested in that. But he comes to formulating something like, it's not a quote, but something like, well, whether they are Christian or not, what matters, what makes them able to make that commitment and to sacrifice yourself is the commitment to absolute moral values and to live in truth. That is the closest that he comes to formulating, which it's almost religious, but it is, let's say, for the people who come from the lay humanist tradition, the closest formulation of that intellectual commitment. And as I say, he embodies that long line of Polish rebellious intellectual tradition, which I was going to say with him is coming to a close. That would have been perhaps an excessive statement, and I hope mistaken. But we feel that with him going, we do not have today other Kurons. So that is the second point. And the third and last, it has already been referred to as well, is that the man of the left, the man who is concerned for the poor, for the workers, who is a symbol of solidarity, helps to bring about, after the defeat of communism, market capitalism, is part of the first government as the Minister of Labour. So the man of solidarity becomes the Minister of Labour, and that change of identity obviously is problematic, as has been said. I will not dwell on that. I will simply say that he later became very critical of that involvement, very critical also of globalization, became associated with all sorts of anti-globalization movements, so rediscovering some kind of perhaps old instinct of his. And final word in conclusion is that really his significance is beyond Poland. He was not unlike Adam Michnik or Geremek, etc., who are sort of the ambassadors of Polish intellectual opposition. He was the man rooted in Poland, also limited by his lack of knowledge of languages, and therefore, yes, he perhaps did not have, he did not travel as well, he was not translated the same way, etc. Nevertheless, he had a very significant impact, certainly for Central Europe as a whole. As a man from Lwów, he had that interest in the eastern neighborhood of Poland, and I think helped to influence the reshaping of the relationship with that area, and that is very topical today. He was also very important for the dissidents elsewhere in Central Europe. Charter 77. I mean, for the influence of Koren and of Kuroń on Charter 77, their meeting, their clandestine meeting at the border, Václav Havel and Kuroń meeting at the border. And I recently spoke about this with Václav Havel, and he said, well, you know, it was that Polish experience and the thinking of people like Kuroń that made an enormous impact, that made the Czech opposition think beyond cultural opposition. They didn't have the same situation, but they started thinking in those terms because there were people like Jacek Kuroń that made it possible. Thanks for your attention.
I thank you very much, all of the panelists.
That concludes tonight's discussion on the legacy of Jacek Kuroń. Tonight's speakers were Andrzej Tomaszewski, Director of International Programs at the American Council on Learned Societies, Patrick Kenny, Professor of History at the University of Colorado Boulder, Johanna Rogalska, Professor of Geography and Chair of the Department of Women's and Gender Studies at Rutgers University, David Ost, Professor of Political Science at Hobart and William Smith Colleges, and Jacques Rupnik, Professor of Political Science and Research Director at CERI, Fondation Nationale de Sciences Politiques, Paris, Professor of History at the Sorbonne, and Professor of Politics at the Institut d'Etudes Politiques, Paris. Moderating tonight's discussion was the Director of the Institute of Human Sciences at Boston University, Irina Grzenska-Gross. For a CD or cassette of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15, which includes shipping and handling. Tonight's program was produced by Matt Odette and Tim Skog, with help from Ian Hughes. Our web producer is Angel Cazelli. I'm Dolores Handy. Thanks for joining us.